Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm very glad you're with us. Tomorrow marks 1 year since the death of Freddie Gray, a 25-year-old young man from Baltimore's Gilmore Homes neighborhood. His death, due to a spinal cord injury while he was in the back of a police van, triggered protests, a riot, renewed calls for change in the status quo for neighborhoods neglected for years. 2015 came to a close with a record level of violent crime, 344 murders, as well as a steep increase in non-fatal shootings. Today, we're going to speak with two community advocates devoted to preventing violence and creating a safe space for young people. Are they hopeful about Baltimore's future? What do they see as the biggest barriers to stopping violent crime? And what difference can a positive role model make in a teenager's life? Erica Alston is Director of Youth Services, Violence Prevention, and Community Outreach at West Baltimore's Penn North Community Resource Center and its Kids Safe Zone. Welcome back to the show, Erica.
Thanks for having me, Sheila.
Munir Bahar is director of the CORE Health Institute, which offers free community fitness programs, martial arts and self-defense training, and yoga classes. He's also founder of the anti-violence group, the 300 Men March Movement. Thanks so much for joining
Thank
us.
Thank you. Welcome.
So let me just start by asking how things feel in the areas where you work. There's a lot of media attention, not the kind of attention there was a year ago or a year minus a week ago, but there's a lot of media attention to it's been a year since Freddie Gray died. It's been a year since the riot. What does it feel like in your work? Munir is
let the queen
gesturing.
Speak first.
For me, it feels exactly like a year ago today. For the exception that the kids' zone is in place. Crime is still up. Sandtown, Winchester is still the most violent zip code in the city. So crime is up. We're still underemployed. We're still unemployed. We're still over-policed. Not much has changed in the 72 blocks that make up Sandtown.
Do you have any sense that change is afoot? That there might be some change coming?
I think the biggest thing that happened is that, and there's an awareness, so people know how bad it is. There are some people genuinely vested in making a change, but this is a decades-long problems that have been in this neighborhood, in this community, for 20, 30 years. So to look a year past Freddie Gray and say, hey, is it better, is unfair to the community. The uprising happened as a result of a community feeling abandoned, neglected, abused, ignored, invisible. So the uprising allowed them to be seen. Some needs to be heard. There are no more jobs have come into the community. Affordable housing hasn't come into the community. And with no more jobs or housing, drug dealing is up. So it looks a lot like it did a year ago today.
Okay, you make a fair point that if the question is taken as a challenge for what has the community done to change, it's not a fair question to ask that in a year. So, Munir Bahar, you can answer it if you want to, or just look back on a year ago and tell me what sticks in your memory from a year ago.
So, well, I'll say this, and I'm not her cheerleader at all, but Erica Alston is a prime example of a person who saw a need, who came in, didn't have all the answers, we never do, but had the commitment, the fortitude, the determination, the courage, the leadership to come in and establish something, you know, in that area for those children. Now, she's one person. Imagine if 20 people did the exact same thing. So what we saw last year, we saw a lot of people, oh, we need to do this, we need to do that, we need to do this. Very few people came in and did something beyond a day. Look, she's still here, still running the Penn North Kids Safe Zone. Children are still coming in. So a sustained action is to be congratulated in a town where so many people come out for one day, for one event, for one time, one night, you know, and then go home and act like a press conference or a town hall meeting or a forum is going to bring about the community changes that they sing about. So, you know, I've been saying forever, we need more citizens to step up. You know, Erica isn't a city council president. She isn't this, you know, an individual who said, I can do something, got her family involved. I can do something and I can sustain it and I'm going to try my best to do it. And I've just watched her and like why it inspires me. And I've been doing this work for 14 years and I'm inspired by her commitment. I'm saying, man, I gotta get to that level. I want to be at that level of sustaining that type of intense intervention that Sandtown needed. So I look at all the folks who've been saying they've been doing something for 10, 15, 20 years. Like, I'm scratching my head. Well, how come y'all don't have a kid safe zone open? If you're such a community advocate, if you know the pulse of the people, you know, you really begin to question those on the ground floor who say they're about things, but yet you see the lack of development, the lack of structures and built environment going up, the lack of programming. You see a lot of people huffing and puffing and puffing and huffing and shouting and shouting and shouting. Where is the strategic community transformation? Taking, as she did, vacant spaces and turning them into something, investing money, you know, creating opportunities for other people to get involved. Where is that? So, you know, what I saw last year was a lot of folks who said, we need to do something. And a year later, those people are still saying we need to do something and haven't done anything.
Okay, I want to ask you more about that, but since you, and you may say you're not a cheerleader, I'll be a cheerleader. I want to ask Erica to summarize. You had just been working at Penn North Resource Center
30 days
exactly. when all this started to happen a year ago. So tell us briefly how you decided what was needed and what you created.
It's very surreal because the day I was in that green room, in this green room, waiting to come on, my executive director, Blaise Connolly Duggan, was going to be a guest on midday. And sitting in the green room, Safe Streets was on, and JT from Safe Streets said, as I'd heard 100 times before, Sandtown, Winchester needed something for the children. There were no resources or recreation or extracurricular things for the kids. And I sat in the green room and I listened. I was like, wow.
Safe Streets, by the way, is the violence interruption program.
Absolutely.
That tries to head off crime.
I said to myself, wow, there it is again. And I looked at Blaze and I said, why can't we be the thing for the children? And in that green room, your green room, he handed me the key to the vacant laundromat. So
This was a laundromat that was already vacant.
It's a vacant laundromat, 1,000 square feet, that was next to the Community Resource Center that the landlords loaned to us to stage the donations that were coming in while the uprising was going. I mean, there were truckloads of things that were coming in for the community, diapers and water and sandwiches. Mm-hmm. And so we borrowed the space just to house stuff. Mm-hmm. And when we got back from here and I had the key, I went into the laundromat, which was gray concrete floors and walls and no color, broken machines. I said, okay. And I wrote a press release on May 5th. And it said, in 4 weeks, on June 1st, we're going to open the Kids Safe Zone. And it'll be a safe place for children in Sandtown, Winchester, ages 5 to 17, open 7 days a week from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. And I didn't realize the work that I was creating for myself. 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, any kid, 5 to 17. And on the first day, we had 40 kids.
The first day you had 40 kids?
The first day.
How many kids have you had?
17,000 visits from children. Over 600 kids have visited in the 10 months that we've been in. So we were in the vacant laundromat for about 8 months. And back to what Munir said, I didn't have money. There was no funding. There wasn't a grant. So I've learned in the past year that you don't have to wait for the perfect space, the perfect funder, the perfect support. I used social media and local media to transform that vacant laundromat into Disneyland. It was flat screen TVs, Xbox gaming systems, the carpet on the floor, the furniture. To this date, every single thing in the Kids Safe Zone has been donated. So hearing a need, seeing the need in the community, and just acting, not having a meeting about setting a date for the next meeting to have a meeting. It was about what does the community need and how do we do it with no money. So We've managed to raise and run on donations for 10 months. And out of the donations, we raised $80,000. We raised in 30 days to move the kids out of the 1,000 square feet into our new facility now, which is 8,000 square feet.
And where is the new
facility?
Right
next door. And it was a for-profit daycare center, completely renovated, vibrant, painted, awesome space. The governor's office, Kaiser Permanente, A&E Television, donated the funds needed to get the kids into the space. There's a computer lab. So when school opened on August 31st, we transitioned to an after-school program. So we're there Monday through Friday from 2 p.m. to 8 p.m. and Saturdays from noon to 6. Because just because school's closed doesn't mean that kids don't still need a safe place. So it's very important that we're there on the weekends. And we're still kids 5 to 17. And we've managed to create a space that there are no more 17-year-olds than there are 7-year-olds. No more boys than there are girls. So to create a loving, caring, nurturing, safe place where a 17-year-old boy is comfortable playing a game of Uno with a 6-year-old girl. I mean, I still cry watching them do yoga. It's been a phenomenal journey to hear and see a need, feel responsible to fill it, go to the community, and most of which didn't look like us. You know, when I say that the community showed up and transformed this place with us, you know, there was this caravan of soccer moms with blonde hair and blue eyes that showed up every day. I've got 5,000 Pop-Tarts with someone named Erica. I've got crayons and Freezy Pops and hula hoops. Like that caravan hasn't stopped. Every day, a UPS truck arrives with something from Amazon.
So the Kids Safe Zone networks beyond Sandtown, Winchester, you're saying beyond the city?
Absolutely.
Does that surprise you, Muneer?
That's the same with my organization. You know, we're supported. We've gotten support from the National Bankers Association in D.C., the Meyerhoff family, the Adams Foundation. I went to speak to a group of bankers in Savannah, Georgia last year. We raised some support for them. So, you know, it's the true picture is that there's a lot of support from other people outside of these communities mm-hmm. in Baltimore who are supporting. I say it all the time. I don't care. You know, black folks want to get mad at me. But, you know, there's a bulk of our money. I would say the majority does not come from black folks.
Doesn't.
It comes from people outside of the black community. Yet we know that we're targeting these young black kids who are in these vulnerable sections. So it really just widens the scope of understanding of who's really involved and who's engaged at really building up the community. And it's this guy all the way out in the suburbs. It's this mom who lives in Canada. Like, we've gotten support through mm-hmm. online from all over the world from people who care. So it doesn't surprise me at all. I know from being in the nonprofit sector, running off of a donations-based organization, where the money comes from. And it comes from everywhere. That's why you can't discriminate. That's why you can't generalize groups of people or religions. Help comes from everywhere.
That's Muneer Bahar, founder of the 300 Men March movement and director of CORE Health Institute here on Midday on WIPR. We need to take a short break. We're going to come back more with Muneer Bahar and with Erica Alston, director of Youth Services, Violence Prevention and Community Outreach at West Baltimore's Penn North Community Resource Center. And we hope that you'll be part of the conversation. Do you think Baltimore has made progress since last year? If so, how would you describe it? Have you seen any changes that you think are worth talking about? Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're reflecting today on progress or lack of progress in Baltimore since the death of Freddie Gray and the calls for change that followed. Has anything changed in the Penn North neighborhood, the epicenter of unrest last year? What do community advocates make of city officials' promises to improve the opportunity and quality of life in long-neglected neighborhoods? Here in the studio with me is Erica Alston, Director of Youth Services, Violence Prevention and Community Outreach at West Baltimore's Penn North Community Resource Center. She has started and is running its Kids Safe Zone. And Muneer Bahar, director of the CORE Health Institute and founder of the anti-violence group, the 300 Men March Movement. And you can be part of this conversation. Did you decide to start volunteering or mentoring in the city as a result of last year's unrest? We would love to hear your story and how things look to you now. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. Erica, you described a vibrant network of support for what you're doing. Until recently, the financial support has not included the city of Baltimore.
Yes, we are exactly a week into receiving our first financial support from the mayor's office, Baltimore City, through the Family League. We submitted a grant for $50,000 to run our summer enrichment program, which will allow 100 kids to participate in our summer program in partnership with Munir, Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. and Saturdays noon to 6. So when the summer starts, the kids will go back to a 12-hour day with us. We asked for 50 and we were awarded 40. So we're very excited about our first large financial support from the city.
And some might say the fact that you have figured out how to tap into the urge of so many people to make things better and to be part of making things better is maybe an indication that it doesn't need to come from a level of government.
Absolutely. And so I agree with that. We have no desire to be 100% reliant on any foundation, any grant, any state or local entity. What the community support allows us to do is operate as we are. It's very hard. Like with foundation and grants, there are specific outcomes that they're looking for. They give you money and you need to provide the outcomes that they're looking for. And for us, being the kids' safe zone, an outcome is none of our kids died last year. You know, in the most brutal summer, 344 homicides, none of our kids died. And that's not sexy language for a foundation.
Seems pretty powerful to me.
Very. That's why we are a drop-in safe place for kids. We're not a learning center. We're not a school. We are a drop-in safe place for kids. And what we've seen is, I say it regularly, if I received a grant for $1 million, I would still use social media. People arrive at the Kids Safe Zone with checks in hand and tears in their eyes and thanking me for allowing them to be a part of the work that we're doing. If I had to put a price tag on the in-kind donations, it would be $1 million. It's restoration hardware and $35,000 worth of really good furniture. Holiday Inn and their furniture, P.F. Chang's and their furniture. The moms who I post, we need a PlayStation 4. That's a need in Santa Winchester, PlayStation 4. We need one and then have four people inbox me and say, I'll do it. We asked for a DVD player a week ago, and on Friday received the sixth DVD player. Every crayon, every chair, every piece of paper, the copy paper, was a car drove onto our parking lot with two boxes of a dozen reams of copy paper. So that keeps us running. However, there's a $4,500 price tag on the rent for the facility. There's a computer lab and flat screen TVs and Xbox gaming systems that require BGE. There's a staff of seven people, over 100 kids every day that require paychecks. That's not the in-kind. Mm-hmm. And so there is some support. There's operating expenses. Our program costs $280,000 a year. That is nothing. That's six employees, the rent, yeah, field trips, $280,000.
That's pretty frugal.
Yeah.
That's pretty frugal.
So that's where the support is needed.
Munir Bahar, the 300 Men March is the 300 Men March movement's message is we must stop killing each other. Why is this your message rather than calling for job creation or more educational opportunity? Why is that the focus?
Because I think all smart, rational human beings understand that the motives of the killing that's happening out here is not based on the singular factor is not material, it's not a job. A cousin of mine was murdered in 2013 that, you know, kind of helped fuel me to start this movement. He was murdered over a car accident in front of his daughters. He wasn't murdered because the guy was looking for a job, or the guy thought, well, if I murder him, then that'll up my stakes in life. You know, a lot of the crime that's happening out here, and I am a former drug dealer and convict. I used to run these streets. So I know best the culture that's embedded in the streets that drives a lot of this crime, and it is cultural. I keep telling people it's a cultural thing. It's an internal warped sense of self, a disregard for the lives of others. You will have people that will kill somebody just over a bad look or a pair of tennis. This is a cultural thing. I remind people that where people of African ancestry come from, we come from places that don't have a lot of material. You know, we come from, and there still exists, you know, third world countries, quote unquote, that don't function off material, but you don't see the level of killing that you see here in America with people of African descent. So material is not an excuse. Because I don't have the job that you have, I'm sorry, that is not an excuse I'm going to pass down to young black men to say, you know what, if you don't have the job you want, that's an excuse to go out here and be violent. Or if you don't have the material, if you didn't get that promotion, if you don't have those tennis, that's an excuse to go out here and be violent. No, it's not. Regardless of the material. So that's been our message from day one, is that, look, we got to solve this ourselves. Young black men are killing young black men. Then young black men have to do an internal assessment, a cultural assessment, and find something deep inside that says, you know, I need to not only preserve my life, but I need to preserve the humanity in others also.
So I need to ask you then, hearing that, there are those who are quite vigilant that what happened on April 27th last year be called an uprising, not a riot. In other words, focusing on the extent to which it was a response to needs in the community. Erica's nodding her head, as opposed to just violence.
No.
I would like your judgment about how we should look back on the events of April 27th.
Yeah, but that was different. You know, we had the uprising going on, but also remember that week we had 10 homicides in that first week of April. So that was a separate thing. The uprising, yes, there are a lot of young, black, frustrated children who are being neglected, who are being abused, who are being taken advantage of. And that was a moment to sort of vent, a moment to let that frustration. I still get frustrated as a young black man that's trying to do something in my community, and the roadblocks that I come into for trying to do something well. So I can understand that. The homicides and the gun violence, that was totally separate. The uprising wasn't about shooting down the next black man, because none of that happened.
No, but it was violent. And violence, I thought, was it would be the link between them, and perhaps it's not. I mean,
well, yeah, total different type of violence. I mean, throwing bricks through windows, smashing cars, that's frustration. That's, you know, what our movement sort of deals with is the violence, the gun violence, shooting somebody, again, the senseless violence, the uprising. I'm not going to say it had to happen, but, you know, when you have bottled up frustrations, you know, it just takes one event for it to come out. And that was that time. The neglect of Baltimore communities is still happening. You know, the underlying reasons or causes for some of those frustrations of a lot of young people across Baltimore are still happening to this day. And that's what I think a lot of people forgot. The uprising wasn't just about that moment. It was about, like Erica said, decades and decades of the mistreatment and missed opportunities, you know, that happened in these communities.
Erica, you were going to say something a minute ago, I think.
The violence, back to what Munir was saying, like, because we deal with kids 5 to 17, over the past year, I know that 13 is late. When we are trying to, when we're doing violence prevention and intervention, 13 is late. I associate, the Kids Safe Zone is a self-efficacy program. It is about self-worth and self-value. Those are the things that allow you to pull a trigger and kill someone that looks like you, because you don't matter. Like, if there is no value, I have no worth. My mom is on drugs. My dad is incarcerated. I live with grandmom amongst my other 7 or 8 cousins. I feel invisible. No one shows up at my football game. I'm now experiencing that. We've got a football team, and I'm the one running up and down the sideline. If there's no parental engagement, if something happens to me, like even with field trips, we go on field trips by me plastering a sign on the door, gone fishing. Yep, there's 80 kids gone out of the community on a bus, gone fishing. If you've got questions, there's my cell phone number. My phone has never rang. Like, no one's looking for you. So if I have no worth, no value, and you look at me wrong, you bump into me, you step on my brand new pair of sneakers, I'm going to act out, and I'm going to act out in violence, because in these 72 blocks, it is what I see. It is normal. So we're teaching conflict resolution, and it looks different. The police officers, if our biggest claim to fame is our ability to have changed the dynamics between these kids in West Baltimore and Western District Police Officers, I'll take it. So police officers are in the Kids Safe Zone every day, and they know these kids by name. So maybe if there's a phone call that a crime is happening in Gilmore Homes Projects, and that officer knows that it's Tyrone, maybe they'll come sooner, because now these kids have faces, and there's some worth and there's some value. And maybe I won't be so quick to pull a trigger, because Miss Erica loves me. Miss Erica encourages me and has a safe place for me. And so does Miss Tonette and our other six members. So we do a survey. Like, what adult outside of the people in your home were you able to talk to before the Kids Safe Zone? Zero. Now, six. That's an outcome. So these kids now feel better about themselves, and I know that we are preventing some violence from happening. I know that we are preventing the potential next Freddie Gray.
That's Erica Alston, Director of Youth Services, Violence Prevention and Community Outreach at West Baltimore's Penn North Community Resource Center. She started the Kids Safe Zone that she's been describing. This is Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Kasten. Also here in the studio with me is Munir Bahar, Director of the CORE Health Institute and founder of the anti-violence group, the 300 Men March Movement. Phil is calling us from North Baltimore. Phil, welcome to Midday.
Good afternoon. The two people on the show know each other and each other's programs. I'm wondering if they could talk a little bit about the similarities, both the programs and the successes, because they emphasized people need to step up and do things. And I think understanding how they were successful, both the message and the tactic, may be very influential in helping other people do things.
Phil, thank you for the call.
Thank you, Phil.
I'll throw
Thanks,
it to you.
Dr. Lee.
So, well, one way that I know we have both been sort of successful is that we've been very transparent with the process of developing our organizations and using social media to show people, you know, there's always a video, there's always a message, there's always an update with what we're doing. Another reason I think, you know, that
why is that? Why is throwing updates and here's what we're up to? Why is that powerful in terms of a result?
Because in Baltimore, people have a short attention span for some reason. So you got to constantly show them that, look, these kids need help. These kids are neglected. I think a lot of people in Baltimore, and I'm talking about the educated, professional, well-off community, we don't really want to know 24/7 the gravity of what's really happening to these children. So it's real easy to tune it out. So we have to do a job of constantly reminding our friends, professional friends, the political friends, here it's what's really happening. I know you had a nice event, you read some nice statistics, but look, we got 100 children right here who are all begging for food, love, and nurturement. And we're going to keep showing you that so that we can't just paint a picture.
Got it.
Otherwise.
Erica, you were about to add
something. I heard something very interesting yesterday. The media will report the airplane crash. They don't report the boarding of the plane. So if we looked at the media to base the safety of airlines, if all we see is crashes, we may never get on a plane. So I show the boarding of the plane from we need paint, to look what you've helped us do, to then there's a kid. Like, my primary work is substance abuse and recovery. Penn North is a drug treatment center. There is still such a stigma associated with drug treatment, and it's not attractive to help recovering addicts. It's not attractive to help ex-offenders, but who can't help children? So to put a face on the need was paramount. Everything that we do for those children, we show it, because we live in such a social media driven society that if it's not posted, it didn't happen. So we could all work in these little silos behind the scene and not let people know what we're doing. But if we show you, it's happening. So what local media and social media has allowed us to do, and why people give, is, like Mania said, you've followed this process along the way, and it makes it personable. You're part of the kids' safe zone. If I had a advisory board or this board of directors, it would be the 12,000 people that follow me on Facebook, because they are the ones who suggestions every need. And we're going on a trip and we need box lunches. So the similarities for us both are, as Munir said, enlisting the community to help, and even our gripes. Like when I said my biggest need is African-American men to show up and mentor these boys, none showed up. To date, they still haven't showed up. Or the ones who did show up treat us just like our dads did. They show up with a shiny gift, get oohs and ahs and claps, and not return until they have another gift. So there were no stable relationships with us and African-American male mentors. And I've said this 1,000 times, and you would think by now that even if it's guilt, a group of African-American men would step up and say, Erica, we're here to mentor your children. It hasn't happened. Instead, the Jewish Volunteer Connection showed up and said, we're not African-American men, but we're men and we're willing to help.
Okay, Munir Bahar, this is your wheelhouse. This is exactly where you put so much effort, is in inspiring African-American men to become mentors.
Yes, I've been doing it for 14 years, and it's
Why
easier.
Why is it so hard?
It's easier to find a grain of salt on a beach than it is to develop, retain a group of African-American men to serve as mentors for longer than 6 months. And I'm telling these guys, these African-American men, these boys, who 80% of them don't have fathers, need that father figure, not for an event, not for a week, for a month, at least get them through high school and college, at least walk them through the major point of their life at where they most need a father. I know so because I never had a father. I'm 35 years old. So I understand through those difficult points in my life, there was a void where I needed, you know, guidance. And so I know what these young men need. I do not know why more black men are not stepping up to take these young men under their wings, and girls.
We need to take another quick break. But before we do, I would like you to enunciate in a sentence or two or three very briefly, what does it mean? What kind of commitment are you asking men to make when you say, be a mentor?
A minimum of 2 years and a frequency of 2 to 3 times a week spending with that young man.
Spending through a few hours? Spending?
Yes, a few hours. We have our program structured around training, reading, going to events, spontaneous things, which is what parenthood is really about. You know, it's the spontaneous.
I guess I'm leaping to the conclusion, we should talk about this on the other side of the break. I'm leaping to the conclusion that black men are not responding. They're not responding to Erica's pleas. They're not responding as much as you would like to your pleas. I'm thinking, they don't think that they can do it. That's
none, but more. You know, I'm going to say
none.
There's a huge void.
Okay,
so
we're going to continue this conversation about what it takes to get young men, especially African-American men, involved in mentoring African-American youth. We're going to take your calls when we come back. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org or call us at 410-662-8780. What are your thoughts about what needs to happen? Have you observed the city doing anything, or are you disappointed in the city's response? Any of that is fair game. Give us a call. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm here with Erica Alston, Director of Youth Services, Violence Prevention and Community Outreach at the Penn North Community Resource Center in West Baltimore, and Munir Bahar, founder of the anti-violence group, the 300 Men March Movement. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm here in the studio with Munir Bahar, director of the CORE Health Institute and founder of the anti-violence group, the 300 Men March Movement, and with Erica Alston, director of Youth Services, Violence Prevention, and Community Outreach at the Penn North Community Resource Center in West Baltimore and its Kids Safe Zone. And we're talking about what's changed or what hasn't changed and what may be about to change in the wake of Freddie Gray's death in police custody about a year ago. You can be part of this conversation. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. Charles is calling us from Woodlawn. Charles, welcome to the show.
First of all, Sheila, I'm a big fan of both Erica and Munir. I've been writing about them for the last 4 years, about what they do and how they do it. I have taken students who are journalism professionals, who want to become journalism professionals, to Munir Bahar's facility down off of Washington Boulevard. Erica and I have had conversations about what can I do to help you. This winter, she came to the Baltimore Association of Black Journalists and asked if we would provide some coats and some toys to her kids, and we did so really willingly.
Charles, is this the Charles who writes for the Washington Post?
No, this is the Charles Robbins who writes for Maryland Public Television.
Oh, Maryland Public Television. Hi, Charles.
All right, no problem. But what I think a lot of people don't understand is they have a wide network of both friends, supporters, and individuals who literally at a drop of a hat will stop what they're doing and do whatever they can to help them. And I know that many times they seem like they're working in a vacuum, and they will never sing their own praises, so I'm going to sing their own praises for them.
But they'll sing each other's praises. So,
and, you know, one of the things I loved was I think Erica had a post about a young man who was not really doing the right things. He was wilding out, and she didn't know how to deal with him, and Munir Bahar just showed up. And that's what that community needs, people to show up. And, you know, and as I've told Erica, you know, I'm a product of that community, and I am coming to see you. I've been a little busy in the last couple of weeks, and, you know, because I want those young people to realize that it's, you know, even though the surroundings around you, there are some great kids in that neighborhood who just need somebody to push them. And that's what these two individuals do.
Charles, I appreciate the phone call and the endorsement.
Thank you so much, Charles.
I'm not even going to let Munir and Erica have time to respond because I'm sure they agree with what you said about each other. Ronald is calling us from Charles Village. Ronald, welcome to Midday. Ronald?
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air, Ronald.
Yes, the brother from CORE, he sounds like the brother that had a martial arts school on Charles Street.
Yeah, we did, yep.
Yeah, I visited his school, and I'm interested in martial arts, and you were doing a very good job, and I live up the street from the radio station. I'm calling to let you know that I'm 64 years old, and I grew up in a dysfunctional family. I had to drop out of school at a young age to go to work to take care of myself because of my family's circumstances. However, I went in the military. I got a GED in the military, and I graduated from college. I graduated from Towson University after trying many, many years to graduate. I finally graduated with a bachelor's degree in sociology and anthropology. And I learned, well, I grew up during the civil rights era, you know, the era of the Black Panther Party, and a lot of those things were going on when I grew up. And the same conditions that existed in the so-called African-American community then, you know, exist today. High unemployment, high crime, you know, illiteracy. You know, those conditions are still there. And that little spark with the Freddie Gray incident just ignited, you know, the flame. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, Ronald, we understand what you're saying. I guess I'm curious as to whether you're saying that the fact that this has been around a long time means it's hopeless, or do you see something new alive in the community now?
You know what? It's very simple. Now, you know, sociologists have done a lot of studies concerning African Americans, you know, and I appreciate, you know, this radio station. They discuss a lot of the studies that's been done in the African American community. But the problem, the solution to the problem is very simple. And my people have to learn how to love and respect each other. My people have a lot of self-hatred. That's why if you look at another black person, they might blow your brains out. You bump into them, they might kill you. They have a lot of frustration. They feel hopeless. They have a lot of self-hatred. They feel like they're worthless. I felt that way. And I turned to God. And if my people learn how to keep God's law, statutes, and commandments, not robbing, not raping, not murdering each other.
Ronald, I appreciate your call. Let me give Munir a chance to respond.
Yeah. I would say, you know, in culmination of it all, it always starts with humanity. You know, people have to learn to respect humanity, not just African Americans. All of us have to, you know, but I know we speak in context of the African American community here in Baltimore. Again, it's mostly young black males killing other young black males between the ages of 15 and 34. And so that is the topic, but it's something that the whole world really needs, you know, again, not just young black men, but we all need to look at how do we embrace the humanity of other people amongst within cultures, within religions, and within others also.
The primary election is already underway with early voting. The main day of voting is next Tuesday. Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake is not running for re-election. Six of the 15 city council members are not running for re-election. So there's clearly going to be a change in political leadership. Do you think that's going to be important?
Yes.
Absolutely.
We have this tired leadership that's been in this town forever, really blocking new, innovative, fresh approaches to dealing with things. I mean, you know, I'm glad you did your job, but you know what? It's time for some new innovative thinkers in there to keep up with the times, and especially to keep up with the pulse of the young children. You know, these younger people are growing up in a total different era than 20 years ago. And so things are different. The way people socialize is different. The way information is spread is different. And so leaders need to be attuned to that and need to be able to cater to young people's development. Because at the end of the day, everything we're doing is for young people. If we're doing something for us, then we have not grown up. Everything we're doing is for young people.
Erica, you look like you wanted to jump in when I asked that question.
Normally, the question is who do we support, and
I'm specifically not going there unless.
So there is no one that what we've learned back to looking
lessons
back.
Learned, yeah, yeah,
is whoever it is, we as a community must hold them accountable. So I am waiting for the day that person is voted in to send an email, make a phone call that we have to meet because it's going to be my responsibility from the time I wake up to the time I go to sleep to hold that person accountable for the children in West Baltimore.
We've got Sherry calling us from Baltimore. Sherry, welcome to Midday.
Hello.
Hello, Sherry. You're on the air. Okay, we lost Sherry. Don is calling from Annapolis with a question. Don, welcome to Midday.
Hi, Sheila. Erica, I just wanted to follow up. Early on, you said that you had received a contribution from the governor's office, and I wanted to know what that was. And I want to commend you both for depoliticizing this issue because it's not a political issue. It's about people, as you say. And I wondered if you would, Sheila, post where you can make donations to both their groups on your website. Thank you, and I'll listen.
We certainly will post links to their website.
Well, Don, thank you so much for your question and your support. When I wore my I voted for Hogan sticker, my friends had a field day. But the day that we got $40,000, we approached Governor Hogan's office when we were trying to raise the $80,000 that we needed in 30 days. So an unprecedented donation was made to us. You don't get $40,000 from any entity in 30 days. But the governor's office gave us $40,000 to meet the $80,000 goal. So it was the governor's office of children, Then we got an additional $10,000 for the computer lab from Governor Hogan's office. And then we got an additional $10,000 to support our supportive housing program. So our support from the governor's office was $60,000.
Don, I appreciate the call. And as I said, we will post both of your websites on our website. They may are already be up there. Ben is calling us from Lauraville. Ben, we've got just a minute or two left. Ben?
Everyone's thoughts on the possibility of mentors coming from the outside, given the time commitment. It would seem that the mentors that everyone's looking for might have families and jobs that might prevent them from being the mentors we want them to be. But if there are volunteers coming from the outside, what kind of mentorship would that look like? And is that even something everyone's interested in?
Ben, I appreciate the call.
Let me say this. Because you have a job and a child is no excuse to watch children be neglected, be abused, and be just discarded from society. I have a child. I have a business. I have a family. So does Erica. We all do. That is what the word sacrifice means. We have been asking Baltimore residents to sacrifice. While you take your son to the basketball game, take two other boys on the block who have no father to the basketball game. So that's the type of spirit that we're trying to drive. It's not about convenience. It's about sacrifice.
Let me give the last 30 seconds to Erica.
Absolutely. I don't discriminate on where a mentor comes from or the amount of time. I ask for consistency. If you are only available on Thursdays at 3 p.m., I'll see you Thursday at 3 p.m., but that's not been the results that we get. As I echo what Munir said, it's about sacrifice. I am in the midst of raising, 90% of my day is spent raising money. I have a family. The Kids Safe Zone is not my job. I'm the director of PR and business development for Penn North. So it's 12-hour days. My kids are at the Kids Safe Zone until 8, 9 p.m. That's a sacrifice as a parent that I'm making. So there are no excuses to watching these kids be ignored and neglected.
I am very grateful to you both for this conversation. You've given us a lot to think about, and you've given me a sense of hope. I'm not sure whether that matches your own or not, but I'm very grateful both for what you do
Thank you.
For sharing it with us. Erica Alston, Director of Youth Services, Violence Prevention, and Community Outreach at the Penn North Community Resource Center in West Baltimore, founder and director of the Kids Safe Zone there. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Munir Bahar, director of the CORE Health Institute and founder of the anti-violence group, the 300 Men March Movement. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today for Midday Guests. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. Features signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. Open for lunch and dinner with breakfast on the weekend on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. And thank you for listening. I'm away tomorrow, but Aaron Henkin will be here for a conversation about how social media sites and crowdsourcing efforts are shaping the way we remember the past, even the recent past. I'm Sheila Cast. Have a great afternoon.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.